Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the hell happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war, before, during, and after war. So let's go. Welcome to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where we have narrated history episodes, and we also have episodes where we sit down with filmmakers, authors, historians, and we talk about wars in history. Today's guest is Tom McMillan. He is a retired sports media veteran, which is really cool. 43 years of experience in that, I believe, in sports reading, and he was also the vice president of communications for the Pittsburgh Penguins. So fans out there, if you're listening, this guy is pretty cool. And he's also a historian, which I think is the coolest. And he's written several books on American history, works with multiple historical organizations, and he's the author of today's book, The Year That Made America, From Rebellion to Independence, 1775 to 1776, The Golden Years. And so, Tom, thanks for joining us today.
Emily, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, so this is a subject near and dear to my heart, not only as an American, but this is what our season one of the narrated side of the podcast is all about, the lead up to the American Revolution. So this I'm looking forward to talking to you about. Okay, so we're talking about the American Revolution simmering and building for a long, long time, and it exploded in 75-76. Bring us into that year a little bit, and what was going on? What was the vibe in Congress at, let's say, 1775?
Yeah, well, thanks, Emily, for this. My focus really was the Declaration of Independence and how that happened. And I was one of, I love history. I've written books on history. But I also realized that sometimes there's parts of history we don't know anything about. And this was... some people ask me, because I've done some stuff in the Civil War, why are you writing a book on this topic? How did this happen? And I said it was kind of one of those lifelong quests that I didn't realize I was on.
Oh, really?
And it's because the anniversary was coming up, and I started to poke around and read, and I realized, embarrassingly, how much I didn't know. Because I really think, especially with the Declaration and the 4th of July, we get a... very snippets of what goes on there. And then
sure.
We skim over it. Everything happens on one day. And I was astonished by how complicated and how controversial it was, and how they battled with one another. And that, in addition to the war going on, this is, the battles in Congress, in a way, we've always had that. So part of it was that, because as you know, when the First Continental Congress got together in 1774, the idea was not to declare independence.
Right.
They wanted to restore our rights under the British Empire. We were British subjects. And John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and George Washington were born as British subjects.
Yeah.
And there might have been a little bit in Massachusetts with those radicals up there, but in 1774 it was pretty much, I think they thought the word wasn't getting through to the king, that Parliament was keeping it from him. And I thought, if we can address the king and write a petition, he will see this and he will redress our grievances.
Surely.
And everything will be fine. And they were so confident in that, that at the end, when the First Continental Congress ended, they said, well, we'll plan to meet again in the spring of 1775 if this doesn't work out. So they were hopeful that that the Second Continental Congress would never happen.
Yeah.
And as we know, it did.
Shocking.
The king wanted no part of this. It either didn't get to him or he didn't want any part of it. There was some condescension there. I think people in England couldn't understand what the colonists were complaining about. I mean, stuff had been percolating since the 1760s with the Stamp Act and the Sugar Act. And the colonists were pretty upset. And I think it's so hard for us to grasp again today. It took so long for word to get across the ocean that thing simmered. It took 3 months to get across, and by the time you got an answer, it was a half a year. So these things really simmered, and maybe in some cases got blown out of proportion, and it was a bucking bronco, and they couldn't stop it. So 1775, you're starting to see in the spring and summer some upset Continental Congressmen, and yet there were enough moderates, probably led by John Dickinson of Pennsylvania, who were saying, hold on here, this isn't the time to start fighting. Even after shots were fired at Lexington and Concord, they thought that that they could write a petition to the king, the olive branch petition, and again, that he would redress their grievances and things would be fine. And John Adams thought it was the silliest thing ever, but it went through, and Dickinson and Thomas Jefferson wrote part of it, and the king, of course, didn't read it, nothing happened, and that that fall and early winter, the king kind of read through what they were doing. He said, I don't think you guys are looking to restore your rights. I think you want independence. And he accused them of independence.
Some of them did. Some did.
And so I'll get to you. I know I'm rambling here, but
no,
part of the book is I list 8 chapters with dates, one of which is not the 4th of July. Because I think, while it's important, there's so much focus there. So I have the 9th of January, the 15th of May, the 7th of June, with the idea being there's so many other dates that were important.
Yes.
Starting with that 9th of January, where a loyalist in the Continental Congress actually was ready to propose a resolution where the Congress would disavow any interest in independence. And when you think of it, this is January 1776. So this wasn't a tidal wave. There were people who were against this right up until the middle of June. So there was consternation within the Congress. And there were factions, as happens in any organization today. It started right away. And you had the radicals, you had the moderates. And you know, when 1776 began, no one could have predicted that there would be a Declaration of Independence in July.
Right. Right. Okay. So that's a pretty cool explanation. And just to add to that, this was at the time, while all of this was going on, all of these letters and petitions to Parliament, to the king, were literally saying, we are your humble subjects and we wish to remain your humble subjects. They weren't saying, like, do this or else. They were like, please do this and we love you and you're the best thing that ever happened to the colonies and we love you. They were really trying to stay in the British Empire. The king just left them no choice.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, there's this idea, I think that where you were talking about up in Massachusetts, there's riots occasionally happening and things like that. And that gets a lot of attention to the point where people might think that all of these revolutionaries were radical or violent or extreme, but they were not. Some, but, you know.
Some had to be brought along. And I think, again, with the way communication was back then, remembering that these things that are happening up in Massachusetts, the Boston Massacre, the Boston Tea Party, whatever, if you're living in Virginia or Georgia, you're not getting all the details. It's not reported in the paper every day, even all the headlines were newspapers, but you're not getting that word.
Yeah.
So a lot of this, I think, by the time the Continental Congressmen got together, even in 1774, some of them were surprised to hear this. They were unaware of it because back then, even those men who were generally wealthy and well off, not many people traveled more than 50 miles from their home.
Yeah.
People in Georgia didn't go to Massachusetts.
Yeah, yeah.
So
different problems, different economies,
exactly.
Different needs. And that was part of what was going on in Congress as well, was you had one side going, you know, we should do this embargo, this total like boycott. And then, you know, you have the more southern colonies going, but cotton and we can't, and rice and we can't. And it was like these debates and these arguments over even whether or not to boycott British goods was not a given. Okay, so really, really interesting stuff. I want to bring up, we're talking about debates and all these different factions. So one of the main things that's going on in your book is the kind of mishmash between Jefferson and Adams. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Between Adams and Dickinson, you mean, or Jefferson and Adams?
Did Jefferson and Adams have? Did they have like some disagreements on how to say things, how to present things, and you know, they weren't totally in lockstep.
Somewhat, but that more blew up. That blew up after the Declaration when they get into politics. They kind of led the partisan politics. Partisan politics breaks out, and the two pillars of independence, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, basically become mortal enemies.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of. Yeah,
and they really, because it was over ways the country should be run. Problems same back then as we have today. And Adams was a Federalist. He believed in a strong central authority, which was a new concept back then. Yeah. And Jefferson was an anti-Federalist, believing the power should be in the states. As you know, there was a lot of feeling about that right up until the Civil War, because this whole idea of a national conglomeration it was so new. Your country was your colony. Your country, that was home. That's the way they viewed things. And so they, you know, in, as you said, Virginia and Massachusetts folks, even they might have the same ideas of independence, but they were going to approach it in different ways. So Adams and Jefferson definitely have very definite ideas about how the country should be governed, and they disagreed. And it, you know, they end up, as the odds, you know, we had such a weak political system to start, where the leading vote getter in the presidential election became president, and the number two vote getter became vice president, even if you were from a different party. So Adams becomes president in Jefferson in 1796, and Jefferson becomes his vice president. It would be like in 2016, Donald Trump became president and Hillary Clinton was his vice president.
That's awful. To like, how? What a dysfunctional way to run things.
Totally. And we eventually got out of that because of this, because Jefferson was not going to support Adams. They had a very distant relationship as president and vice president. Then they run against each other in 1800. Yeah. Jefferson defeats Adams. Adams refuses to go to the inauguration. He goes home early. And they didn't read, write, or talk to one another for more than 10 years. When you think of these guys, you know, they're together with independence, and yet they had this long, bitter feud. They eventually come together at the end. And they write, we ought to explain each other. And they never really agreed, but they became cordial. And I think, as often we have when we're older, we did some pretty cool things here. We were pretty good. But during 1775, the combatants were really John Adams and John Dickinson of Pennsylvania. Dickinson was the leading moderate, as they're debating whether there should be independence or not, whether it was the time. And Dickinson knew independence was going to happen, probably. He just didn't think it should happen then. And he and Adams really butted heads, and they were both brilliant men, both lawyers, and they had, you know, on the great debates of July 1st, 1776 at Congress, they led the way for their respective charges, and they debated, the Congress debated for 9 hours that day.
So long. Okay, when did Dickinson think that independence should happen, if not now?
Never said. He just thought that it was, he never said, you could tell. I mean, he was a little bit radical in the 1760s. He wrote some things anonymously where he wanted rights, but he just didn't think it was time. I think he was afraid of the power of the British Empire and the British military. And what are we doing? Are we going to, you know, send more of our troops to death? This can't possibly work. It was really a long shot to think that the Continental Army, just thrown together, could defeat the British military. At the beginning, you didn't think that was going to happen. And basically, we outlasted them. The Continental Army didn't really defeat the British on the battlefield. The British threw up their arms because the Continental Army, the colonists, were so determined, and they were stubborn, and they kept fighting. Even though they lost all these battles, they kept fighting, and the Brits eventually gave up. But I think he was, you know, his speech on July 1st, he said, this is like going on the ocean in a skiff made of paper. This is not the time to do it. And he knew, he could sense. I will give Dickinson credit for sticking up for his values, because he knew that it was going the other way, and that he was going to lose all of his popularity by doing this, and he did it anyway. And he even said that in his speech. We have the notes of his speech. He said, my once great popularity is now going to be diminished. And to his credit, he joins the militia and fights in the Revolutionary War.
Okay, give him lots of credit.
Think of a politician today doing that. I wrote a line that you could learn some lessons from that. He made his stand, and then he was still going to fight for his country. So he in the John Adams miniseries, which really had a big influence on me, the Dickinson character is, you don't really like it at the end. But I disagree with John Dickinson, but I ended up liking him when I learned about him.
Yeah, and when you think about it too, like, that's probably one of the hardest things for me to imagine, is a Congress member actually putting their literal life on the line to fight for their country. Like, that seems, I can't even imagine what that would feel like seeing that today. Sometimes you see people who are veterans who did put their life on the line, and there's a lot of respect for them, whatever side of the aisle that they're on. But it's hard to imagine a war going on our soil and just being like, well, I'm out of here. I'm going to go pick up a rifle. You know,
And obviously they plucked George Washington right out of Congress to be the commander. But there was also a man named Thomas McCain from Delaware who voted for independence and then didn't sign the Declaration until 1777 because after he voted, he went off to fight the war. So there were a number of these guys who were in their local units, and they went off to fight and serve, and they came back to Congress when they could.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the various votes that were going on. We have, obviously, there's June, and there's May and January. Can you tell us just briefly, like, what these big votes were about?
Yeah, in January, it never got to a vote. This resolution to disavow independence never got to a vote, but it was proposed. I was intrigued by that. Samuel Adams and some of the radicals delayed, and it went away. And then in mid-May, there's a really interesting date, the 15th of May, as I call it. Two things happened. The Congress had, without much fanfare, passed a resolution that all the colonies should make sure that they each had their colonial governments in order, maybe even write a constitution. That was... Everybody agreed to that. But then they thought they needed a preamble. And over the weekend, that was passed on a Friday, over the weekend they formed a three-man committee, and John Adams was on the committee. And he wrote a fiery preamble that was three times longer than the resolution had introduced.
He loved to write, didn't he?
And he basically went after the British and the king and said the British power should be suppressed. He did. And the resolution had to be voted on again. And it only, this is May 15th, it passed by 6-4 with one abstention. All the delegations didn't show up every day. Congress is kind of haphazard. But it was, they all wanted the governments, but this is mid-May, 6-4. They weren't really sure that they were going to get a groundswell of support for independence. And that kind of continued into June when Richard Henry Lee proposed independence on June the 7th. They started the debate right away. And Jefferson writes that they realized they were so fractured that had they taken a vote then, this is less than a month before the Declaration of Independence, it might have passed by a vote of 7-6. That there were six colonies in early to mid-June who either were still against independence or the delegations in Philadelphia did not have approval from the assemblies back home to make that vote. They weren't able to act independently there. They were appointed by their assemblies back home, and what they said you could do, and some of them weren't ready. So they, because of that, they called a three-week delay. That's how we get into early July. They said, let's write back to our local assemblies and see if we can get more clarity on how they want us to vote. But it was, so Jefferson's saying it would have been 7-6, which obviously wouldn't, you know, that much dissent, you wouldn't have moved forward with that. Yeah. So those are parts of things, Emily, that struck me is you're within a month of passing it, and it was still that split. I confess, I didn't know that. I didn't realize that heads were still butting that much, and it was because we get caught up in the 4th of July and the fireworks and self-evident truths and all men are created equal, and we ran forward and won the Revolutionary War. You know, there are certainly people who think we won the Revolutionary War on July 4th, 1776.
Right, that's interesting. I have to admit too, when I started the podcast, the narrative side, where I actually start in the late 1500s in England, just to really bring everybody into why Britain was so desperate to colonize and why they just held on to America so tightly. And right from the very start, the very first foot we set in Jamestown, we were promised essentially no taxation without representation, that we had those same rights as all British subjects, and how it just grew from there. So I go back, like, way back to really bring us forward, and there are so many things that I learned reading these primary sources and just going years on the deep end and this stuff. Like, I think that the average person, including the history fanatic, doesn't know a lot of this stuff. And that's why I think things like your book, it goes, so we're going over these like broad strokes here, but your book goes into a lot of detail on what happened.
Yeah.
And I think that anybody who's interested in this area could really learn a lot from your book, reading these things and reading everything that happened. It's shocking.
I found it the same way, and I think that's the case, and I think a lot of us, and this one, I was embarrassed at how little I know. This book was a research journey by me to learn, and hopefully I take the reader along on that, because I never knew these things, even to the point where I'm a big Outer Banks, Sir Walter Raleigh guy, and Jefferson leaned on some of the things that Sir Walter Raleigh had written or talked about. In the late 1500s, he believed that set up that Americans were already independent. So there are all these little connections that are quirky, that are important to them, and explain, it's the context of explaining why this is important. And that's, you know, for your work doing that, people don't, it didn't start on July 1st, 1776. And these feelings are built up over years and decades and centuries. And if you don't dig into that, you can't really comprehend what happened. On top of the fact that there was very little communication and not much media. So people didn't know what was going on the other side of the world or on the other side of their own continent.
Yeah, and there was a point at one point that I'm trying, it's escaping me now, if it was during around the 1760s with the proclamation line, or if it was right before we declared independence, when Congress wrote a letter to the British people explaining what they were doing and explaining their grievances, because they're like, I don't think people over there are really hearing about all of this. They really tried to make people understand, but communication very hard.
It took so long to get. You're right, that was one of the documents. I think that was the one written by John Jay, the future first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who was for a long time a moderate, and then he turned, once the Declaration was declared, he turned radical. But he was a moderate, and yet he was. This was again trying to restore our rights. They were convinced that the king, perhaps, and the British people did not know what they were saying, and they thought what they were saying was reasonable. Maybe big bad Parliament was keeping it from its constituents and the king. Yeah. And it turned out not to be true, but that's what we thought. And that's why the moderates of John Dickinson stretched this out for a while. And when he wrote the Olive Branch Petition the summer of 1775, and John Adams, I can imagine him stomping around the State House in Philadelphia, now Independence Hall, saying, why are we doing this? You know, Adams wanted to move forward. But I think it was an important part of the process to do that. Dickinson was right. Let's try everything we can to get them to see if they can agree with us. And if they don't, then we have to make a decision.
Yeah. And it's really interesting, too. I've read a lot of John Adams' correspondence to his wife while he was in Congress. And he was so almost forlorn, just like he wasn't sure how it was going to go. And it was this like, oh, but if only everyone could do this and maybe one day, you know, like it was like there was a lot of uncertainty as this was going on. What was going to happen?
Absolutely. And he would write his letters to his wife are so valuable because he really spilled out his guts and hers back to him. And obviously, you know, she really was ended up being his chief advisor. And you would see that. And what it meant for fans of this or historians who may not know this, the National Archives has an incredible site called Founders Online, where they have digitized tens of thousands of letters and documents from the founding fathers.
Amazing.
And you can go, and they're annotated. You can go on and see letters to John Adams, letters from John Adams. If you have the date, you can go on. People said, where'd you go to do your research? I said, I did it in my office at home. Because there's, most people don't, I've talked to a bunch of history friends. No one, they did not have an idea that this was there. Nor would I. I was poking around one day and I found it. So all these letters are there. If you're interested in one of those guys, you can find it. Benjamin Franklin's letters go back to the 1740s.
Yeah. I poked mostly around on Congress. Our Congress library has some letters. It's not as user friendly as something like what you're describing. Yeah. Probably is more user friendly. I feel like the Congressional Library is kind of almost like a Wikipedia chain where you're like clickety clickety.
It is.
And then also there's a lot of the Internet Archive has a lot of free books that are just the minutes of these congressional meetings and things that have everything recorded down as it happened, which is For me, it's a fascinating read, and I think other...
it is, but the one thing that's frustrating is, and I think this was because they were trying to keep some secrecy. They didn't want everyone to know what was going on. Yeah. And they were a little, you know, these guys were going to hang for treason if it didn't work out. So some of the journals of the Continental Congress are in 1776 aren't really detailed. They're the barest skeletal details, which are valuable, but I think they didn't want to put this all down in print lest it get out and back to England, to get to the British troops who weren't all that far away.
Yeah.
And so part of this is detective work of piecing, using that foundation and then taking the letters and piecing them together and see who knew what when. And I was amazed that I found only two letters on the 4th of July.
Only two.
Of the Continental that wrote on that date, because they didn't think that date was that important.
That's crazy. That is crazy. You know, it really gives you an appreciation for historians that go into like 13th century, 14th century stuff. And you're like, how do you even find these freaking sources?
And I don't know how you did this 20 years ago. The Gordon Woods and those historians and McCullough and who found this stuff without the access, the ability to do it online and just hit, you know, if you find the source, you can click
it. It's like a real superpower. Yeah.
It really is. Thankfully, they did what they did. And this book would, if I had to do it that way, the book would come out 5 years from now, because it would take so much longer to do that research. But you can really, you know, and I try to have a pretty detailed notes and bibliography there so people can, you know, see those letters.
They're
fascinating. And the annotated letters, because some of you can read the letter. You're saying, what does this mean? It's language you don't understand. Where did this come from? But because they annotate it, just a tremendous amount of work. It really gives you some clarity. Gave me clarity as to what happened and opened my eyes to what these guys were thinking. And not just John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin, but you know, represented from Connecticut and Delaware and Rhode Island and people you've never really heard of. And one thing that I laughed at, and Josiah Bartlett from New Hampshire, who in the series West Wing, President Jed Bartlett was a descendant of Josiah Bartlett, who signed the Declaration of Independence. So,
I was rewatching
West Wing, and I didn't realize it the first time I saw it. I said, "That's a pretty good connection." Because
once you've been in the weeds of all this research,
you recognize the name. Yeah, see, you're laughing and you're wondering if anybody else. Because the other thing, you know, that you find, one thing I found when Richard Henry Lee proposed independence, he used an interesting phrase. He said, these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states. And that phrase, are and of right ought to be, is odd, but I learned that he did not pull that out of thin air. That was a phrase that Parliament used in the 1760s to admonish the colonists during the Declaratory Act. Richard Henry Lee, devious as he was, it ticked him off, and he remembered it. And more than 10 years later, he uses that phrase. He never wrote that. That's why he used a phrase. But it had to be why he used a phrase, right?
I've
seen it twice. That document, and he did it. And 99% of the people who read it then and read it now would have no idea. But he knew the king and Parliament would know what he was saying. It was kind of like a finger in their eye. He was very pleased with himself.
Yes, that's very fiery.
Those are the kinds of things and I'm just reading I'm doing the early research, writing the early chapters. And when you write books like this, I'm trying to get through to the Declaration of Independence. I'm trying to grind through the early stuff. But you've got to give the reader, a foundation of what's going on. And I read that phrase and I thought, damn, that's really cool. I've never read that anywhere. And I'm sure some great scholars know that, but nobody wrote about it.
I didn't put that together, but I'm remembering reading that phrase when they were being admonished. Yes, that is the respect for that.
So
that
Richard Henry Lee, he was ticked off, and it stuck in his craw for 10 years, and he got them back. So I kind of like the fact that he did it. And the other thing is that I think people say, I read in a book that early on that Richard Henry Lee should be in the pantheon of great founders of the Revolutionary era, and you don't hear much about him, and yet he was the guy who proposed independence in Congress. He was a firebrand.
Why isn't he more well known, do you think?
My only guess is that Speaking back then, your colony was your country.
Yeah.
What was happening back home was most important. So right after he proposes independence, the Virginia Convention is working on their colonial constitution, and they wanted him, he was such a heavyweight, they wanted him back home to help them. George Mason, another patriot, wrote, "Brother, we need you back here," and his wife was ill. So basically, Richard Henry Lee proposes independence, and then he leaves Philadelphia. And he's gone for a number of months. And I think that's why he was forgotten. I believe there was a 5-man committee that Jefferson and Adams were on that was tasked with overseeing the Declaration. They assigned Jefferson to write it. But I think Jefferson it was geographically diverse. Jefferson was the Southerner. He was Virginia's rep.
Yeah.
I believe if Richard Henry Lee had not left, he would have been on that committee. Thomas Jefferson would not have been on the committee. And either Lee or John Adams would have written the Declaration of Independence.
Oh, that would have been way crazy. That would have been really bonkers.
But I think you can carefully deduce that he was so powerful that his departure left an opening. You needed a Southerner. You needed a Virginian on that committee.
Yeah.
And Jefferson had just come back to Congress. He was a young guy. He was 33. He was a brilliant writer. So he was added to the committee. And Adams had some. The other thing that's funny, John Adams was, years later, so ticked off that he didn't write the Declaration of Independence, because he thought the vote was going to be the most important thing.
Right.
He thought leaving the debate in the vote, and he was on 20 or 25 committees. He didn't have time to write this propaganda document. So basically, Jefferson, you go ahead and write this. And then later, Jefferson becomes the hero of independence. And when Adams did so much on the floor, and he kind of harumped about that to his dying day, that he thought he should have. I love John Adams. He's my favorite founder.
But he
was vain. He was vain, and he was jealous. So it's kind of funny.
Right. I think that's how it would have went down if he had stayed in Philadelphia. I think that's a pretty solid idea that Jefferson wouldn't have been it.
And how history would have changed. Jefferson might not have become president then. I mean, history turns, Emily, on these little quirks that aren't attached to anything, but something happens. They want him back home. His wife is ill. He goes home, and all this happens, and somebody else, becomes the hero.
We're living in this other, like, multiverse version of what happened versus if he had stayed kind of thing.
Yeah, that's
interesting. Didn't Jefferson and Adams both die on July 4th in the same
year? It's the most ridiculous quirk of fate in American history.
Yeah.
These two guys have now they've buried the hatchet, they become friends. They die on the same day, July 4th, 1826, the 50th anniversary of the Declaration. How could that possibly happen?
Each other. Yeah,
exactly.
That's crazy.
And it wouldn't have known it at the time, but people thought it was divine intervention.
Sure,
that kind of ensconced the Declaration. The one thing that got to me, Emily, and you'll appreciate this, but by early 1777, the Declaration of Independence in the short term was forgotten. Mm-hmm. It was brushed aside because it had done its duty. It declared independence. We still have a war to fight.
Yeah, like what are you going to do with the paper?
Because if we had lost the war, they ripped that up and nobody cares about the Declaration of Independence. The Brits would have been laughing at us. So it's only in later years, in part because of the battle between Adams and Jefferson, and then certainly because of them dying on the same day, that it becomes iconic. And then Lincoln adds to that with the Gettysburg Address. So their phase is why it's so much more important now than it was even back then.
It's hard not to think of it as some sort of divine intervention. Like that's a powerful symbol. Both of them dying on July 4th, the 50th anniversary. Like
not on July 2nd and not on the 47th anniversary. On July 4th and the 50th anniversary.
Yep.
How did that possibly happen?
And yet,
so it adds to the magic and mystery of this whole process.
So, okay, I want to ask you real quick. So we were talking about sources and reading through things and all this, and I can't help you. Probably are the same as me when it comes to this. When you're reading these minutes of like, then this happened, and then this person said this, and this, and this, and this was the debate, you're reading these primary sources, not just somebody's interpretation of it. I can't help but going like, oh, he said what? Oh my God, like no way, he said this to blah. And it feels like so present, like it feels like it didn't happen hundreds of years ago. It feels like no way, how's he gonna react? Do you feel that sense And I want to ask if there's any debate that was really saucy like that, that just sticks out to you.
Yeah, well, Doris Kearns Goodwin, the great historian and author, said that when she was doing the book on Lincoln's cabinet, that she felt like she was going to bed with them and waking up with them. They were constantly in her mind. They were her friends while that was going on. And that does happen here. You feel like you're really into the weeds, and you feel like you learn a little bit about their personalities. You can see who they were. And even sometimes in the journals of the Continental Congress, the notes, you have to read the notes too.
They
explain things. There was a time between Jefferson and, I'm sorry, between Adams and John Dickinson, where Adams had written a letter where he was making fun of John Dickinson, and it got intercepted in the mail by the British, and it was run in the British papers.
Ooh.
And they ran into each other one day behind the State House, which is now Independence Hall, and Dickinson brushed right by him, and Adams was saying he's not going to speak to me for a while. So even back then, Adams would have been embarrassed. Somebody, it's like today would have been the leak. Somebody would have whispered it to the Washington Post. But somebody gets the letter, writes about it, and Dickinson was furious. But it was what Adams really felt. So some of these guys really didn't like each other.
And then
I think in later years came around, as sometimes great athletes I've covered, when you're rivals, you don't like each other, and later you said, hey, we did some pretty cool things. And I think that's what happened to jump around to Adams and Jefferson, when they were silent for so long, and then Dr. Benjamin Rush, another member of Congress from Philadelphia, was the one who got them together and said, this is silly. You guys drove us. Without the two of you, we wouldn't have independence. Why don't you start to write? And they did. And they wrote, and I think, you know, it thawed, and they wrote some great letters back and forth. They still never agreed on the form of government. They disagreed on that.
That's a hard one to agree on.
But they politely disagreed. And it's because of that. You know, one of the things, Emily, also of doing this, mentioned for secrecy and worry about treason, they often didn't write a lot publicly back then of what happened. They left some gaps. Mm. A lot of what we know today was written by Adams and Jefferson in the 1820s. They wrote voluminously in the 1820s looking back, because what happened, you know, there was another war, the War of 1812, where we're fighting Britain again. And after, that's the next generation. And the War of 1812 generation, I think, was the one that was saying, wait a second, this all happened so fast. How did we become independent? We don't really know that story. Two of these guys are still alive. So people started asking questions of Adams and Jefferson, and they started to write. And so as historians, you have to take this a little bit with a grain of salt, because they certainly were first-person participants. They knew. But it's 40 years later. They're older men. And they're also going to remember how they want to remember it. So you go through that, and they disagree, and they misremember it. But it's really valuable as they write what, you know, what happens and how they remembered things differently, which is also fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wanted to say, before I forget, so during the lead up to the Civil War, we know that there's that famous caning incident where that congressman just beat the hell out of the other one in congressional chamber with his cane. But I think there was some form of violence very similar in the backdrop to the American Revolution. I'm trying to remember if it took place in the Virginia Congress or the Philadelphia Congress. Do you know about that?
No, one doesn't come to mind. I know the Civil War era one, but I think these people really didn't know each other when they came together, and there was. Tempers flared. Tempers were raised.
There was somewhere that said there was another incident like that where I'm like trying to like remember what it was all about, but it just sticks out to me like, man, people were really angry, even about small things like, should we boycott English goods? No, that might ruin a southern colony, but the northern colonies were like, yeah, psh, we don't care. We'll boycott, you know, because they had a totally different economy and tempers, yeah.
When I'm reading this, because I've done so much work in the Civil War, you can see the embers of the Civil War happening too. And Jefferson did have in his I was fascinated with the editing work that Congress did on his original draft of the Declaration. There were, you know, Jefferson was the primary author of the Declaration of Independence, obviously. He wrote the original draft, but there were 86 editorial changes made, some by the committee and some by all of Congress. And the Congress cut one third of his work, just disregarded it. But if you read in the book at the end, I publish Jefferson's original draft. You can read what he wrote and then what it became. And people generally agree that even though group editing is really difficult, that Congress did a really good job editing. They made the Declaration better. Everyone agreed with that but Jefferson. They edited it publicly for 3 days, July 2nd, 3rd, and 4th in Philadelphia, and he was squirming the whole way. At one point, Benjamin Franklin had to walk over and put his arm around him and tell him a couple of anecdotes, but Jefferson never got over it. In the weeks and months later, he would write out his original draft, and he would write out a final approved version. He would send it to his friends and say, "Whose is better? Is mine better?" And almost to a man, they would say, "Oh, Thomas, yours is better. Yours is better. They mangled your words. Of course, Thomas, yours is better." But sometimes, and I, you know, frankly, as a writer, you hate to be edited. You know, years later, they really made my book better, and they really did a good job. But you're so proud of your work, and you agonize over those words that in the moment, and for poor Jefferson, he's being edited while he's in the room. It's like they're taking away his baby. They're taking away his words. And he thought those words were carefully chosen. But you have 50 men in Congress who are all A-plus personalities. Yeah. They all want their input. And again, generally, historians and scholars think that Congress did a pretty good job, that they did improve the writing. And Jefferson may have come around to that, but he wasn't there at the beginning.
I would love to see like a Family Guy skit about that or something. Is really funny to think about, but also I would understand his frustration.
Well, in one of my great quirks, this is only a line in the book, but you talk about the little things that make you proud and the excited. There is a passage of the Declaration on the wall of the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C., that was not written by Thomas Jefferson. It's one of the edited lines that was put in by Congress. And people, of course, don't know that because generally most people think Thomas Jefferson wrote the whole thing, right? That's what we're always taught. He's the author. Well, so they're putting together the memorial in the 1940s, and they have a committee, and they have to whittle down which phrases are going to be on. But the president was FDR, and he was a big Jefferson fan, as many presidents are. And he wanted his own crack at it, and he knew that in the 1776 era, the most important paragraph to them was the last one. That's where they declared independence. We think of that second paragraph with self-evident truths and all men are created equal. They breezed over that back then. They declared it in the final paragraph, and Congress rewrote some of that to get specific phrases in there to make it clear. And FDR knew it was important. He just didn't know Congress had done the editing. So he picked one of those phrases that Jefferson did. So it doesn't really matter. It just shows you that sometimes...
So cool. Yeah.
Then history plays a little. History can play a joke on us a little bit because everybody believes that story that Jefferson wrote the whole thing, and naturally it was going to be edited, and it was edited for improvement.
Yeah, they deserve recognition too, not just Thomas Jefferson. Everybody who had a hand in it deserves a sentence on a wall or some recognition. You know?
And the frustrating thing is, of the 86 changes, Jefferson identified 7 of them, gave credit to Adams and Franklin for 7 of them. The others, we don't know who made them. We don't know. Congress was silent on that. Again, they were trying to move on, and the war was going on, and the British were threatening on Long Island. And I think the thing that struck me was sometimes we think they're doing this in isolation in Philadelphia, like they would be in Washington, D.C. The war was very close. At any point, the British Army and Navy might show up there. They didn't know that. So, the nerves of steel they had to have to do all this while the war was going on.
Yeah, like it was so important that they weren't like, "Oh, we're going to table this." They're like, this is why we're even fighting. This is what we're doing. So, that's okay. So, before you go, I know you're just coming out with this, so this is going to be available April 15th April 15th in about a week from now. This is going to air April 15th too, and so then you could buy this book, The Year That Made America. You find it on Amazon, anywhere that you find books and all that. So I know this is kind of like a silly question because you're just coming out with this book, but do you have any plans for a future book after this?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I'm now addicted to this. It's not. Right, it's my hobby in retirement.
Nuggets of what you're.
Yeah,
do.
Yeah. My first book was on Flight 93.
Okay.
Shanksville, Pennsylvania is close to. I grew up in Pittsburgh and lived in Pittsburgh, and it was close. And I wrote that. That got my book writing career started, and I really. It was an emotional experience and very enjoyable. I am working on a book now for next year on the 25th anniversary because, and not a lot of people realize this, those families still haven't gotten justice.
Oh.
The five Al-Qaeda guys who we know, we're pretty sure we're involved in the planning, who are down, who've been in Guantanamo for 25 years, still haven't gone to trial. Now they're held, they can't, but they still haven't gone to trial. And the families still have a lawsuit against the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia pending because they think the Saudi government actually had a hand in helping some of the hijackers. Now that's never been proven. It's saucy, it's controversial, but the families are taking this to court. So these two things are hanging over their heads. And I was talking to some of the family members, and one I said, I don't think people know this, because a lot of people think Obama closed Guantanamo in 2009, which he said he would. People don't realize they're still down there. And there's really only one reporter from the New York Times who does the report. So if you don't read the New York Times or don't follow it, you don't know this. But I just think, I feel for the families. And some of them are just so frustrated now. And people have died without ever getting any justice.
Oh,
and now there's a debate of what justice will be. But I just wanted to really, and I think now also part of it was retelling the 9/11 story, because a third of the country wasn't even born.
Oh, yeah, right. So there's like all these different layers and layers to this.
Yes.
Very messy, it sounds
like. Yeah, so it's going back and kind of retelling the story and how these guys were captured and why they have been held at Guantanamo since 2006. Right. And they've been there since 2006. It's 2025 now, and they still haven't gone on trial. And there's no indication that it will be before the 25th anniversary.
Are you going to dig into a little bit about the debates on what justice even looks like? And now people, these families have to deal with that even being a debate. It's not this clear-cut thing like it was at the time.
Yes.
That sounds horrible.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's intense research, but I think it's a story that needs to be told. And I think, again, there's been some stuff in the New York Times, but nobody's really written about it. And I thought for the 25th anniversary, it would retell the story of 9/11, but also make people aware that this still hasn't been adjudicated. How could that have been the case? Those guys were captured in 2002 and 2003, and part of the problem was, instead of being taken directly to court or even to Guantanamo, they were taken to CIA black sites and tortured.
Yeah.
And because the goal back then was to find out, it wasn't to find out what happened on 9/11. We were pretty sure we knew that. It was to stop any future attacks.
Yeah.
And because of that, that murkiness of what happened there, that the defense attorneys have been able to pry that open. And we don't know. That's the main reason they haven't been able to go to trial. And people have not been able to come to grips with it. Pretty much, sure, we know these guys are guilty. At one point, they were all going to confess. But we can't get them to trial. So the book is that exploration. And it's dangerous to write a book while it's going on, because I might have to write the book before the story is ended. It might continue to go on. But that's, at least when you're writing about 1776, you know what happened.
Yeah, you know what happened, yeah. And, that's crazy to think about, a murderer or a serial killer in 20 years, no trial, that kind of thing. But these guys are like 9/11. That's way bigger than just one murder being committed.
And I'm convinced. 20 years. I talk to friends of mine who are very learned and pay attention to media, and they say, "What? It's still going on down there?" And I thought that emboldened me that I have to write to write this.
Okay.
Somebody has to know this story is there. So I'm going from 1776 to modern day.
Let me know when you're done writing that book. I'm going to read that. That'll be interesting.
We'll do that.
Yeah. Okay. So again, thank you so much for coming on the show and answering all these questions. And I'm really excited to read that new book. And I think people interested in American history should read this current book that's going to be coming out April 15th, The Year That Made America, From Rebellion to Independence, 1775 to 1776. You can get on Amazon and anywhere else that you find books. Tom, thank you for being here.
Emily, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. Bye.
Bye.